Face the Nation, coming up next.
Big data may be just another overused buzzword, but storing, sharing, protecting, and recovering big data is a big deal to companies, big or small. Barracuda Networks offers powerful, affordable, yet easy-to-implement solutions for data protection and disaster recovery, email archiving, file sharing, and e-signing, all designed to protect big data and simplify IT. For an online demo or to try any of our storage solutions risk-free for 30 days, visit barracuda.com/bigdata.
The eyes of CBS News film cameras, Face the Nation.
I'm Bob Schieffer, and on this 60th anniversary of Face the Nation from the Oval Office in Washington and the Bush Library in Dallas, two presidents in 1 hour. President Obama reveals the next step in the war on ISIS.
We're now in a position to start going on some offense.
And former President Bush talks about the book he's written about his dad, and whether his brother Jeb will be the next Bush to seek the White House.
I think it's 50-50.
Plus an all-star panel of analysts. 60 years of news, politics, presidents, foreign policy, analysis, and culture. Because this is Face the Nation.
Mr. President, thank you so much for joining us on the 60th anniversary of Face the Nation.
Congratulations.
It's a pleasure to have you.
Wonderful to have you here.
Thank you. I want to start with your decision to basically double the size of the American force in Iraq, to bring it up to about 3,000. When you ordered the airstrikes 3 months ago, you didn't seem to think that was going to be necessary. What is this signal, that what we've done so far hasn't worked?
No, actually, what it signals is a new phase. First of all, let's be clear. ISIL is a threat not only to Iraq, but also the region, and ultimately, over the long term, could be a threat to the United States. This is an extreme group of the sort we haven't seen before, but it also combines terrorist tactics with on-the-ground capabilities, in part because they incorporated a lot of Saddam Hussein's old military commanders. And, you know, this is a threat that we are committed not only to degrade, but ultimately destroy. It's going to take some time. What we knew was that phase one was getting an Iraqi government that was inclusive and credible, and we now have done that. And so now what we've done is, rather than just try to halt ISIL's momentum, we're now in a position to start going on some offense. The airstrikes have been very effective in degrading ISIL's capabilities and slowing the advance that they were making. Now what we need is ground troops, Iraqi ground troops, that can start pushing them back.
Will these Americans be going into battle with them?
No. So what hasn't changed is our troops are not engaged in combat. Essentially what we're doing is we're taking four training centers with coalition members that allow us to bring in Iraqi recruits, some of the Sunni tribes that are still resisting ISIL, giving them proper training, proper equipment, helping them with strategy, helping them with logistics. We will provide them close air support once they are prepared to start going on the offense against ISIL. But what we will not be doing is having our troops do the fighting. What we learned from the previous engagement in Iraq is that our military is always the best. We can always knock back any threat. But then when we leave, that threat comes back.
Should we expect that more troops may be needed before this is over?
You know, as Commander-in-Chief, I'm never going to say never. But what, you know, the commanders who presented the plan to me say is that we may actually see fewer troops over time, because now we're seeing coalition members starting to partner with us on the training and assist effort.
I want to get back to foreign policy, but I also want to ask you about what happened on Tuesday.
We got beat.
Yeah. Harry Truman once famously said, if you want a friend in Washington, get a dog. And I thought of that when I heard the chief of staff of the Democratic leader of the Senate, Harry Reid, say, and this is his quote, "The president's approval rating is basically 40%. What else more is there to say?" He's basically saying it was your fault. Do you feel it was your fault?
Well, look, another saying Harry Truman's was, the buck stops with me. The buck stops right here at my desk. And so whenever, as the head of the party, it doesn't do well, I've got to take responsibility for it. The message that I took from this election, and we've seen this in a number of elections, successive elections, is people want to see this city work. And they feel as if it's not working. The economy has improved significantly. There's no doubt about it. We had a jobs report for October that showed that once again, over 200,000 jobs created. We've now created more than 10 million. The unemployment rate's come down faster than we could have anticipated. Just to give you some perspective, Bob, we've created more jobs in the United States than every other advanced economy combined since I came into office. And so we're making progress, but people still feel like their wages haven't gone up, their incomes haven't gone up. It's still hard to save for retirement, still hard to send a kid to college. And then they see Washington gridlocked, and they're frustrated. And you know, they know one person in Washington, and that's the President of the United States. So I've got to make this city work better for them.
All the presidents in modern history who have been successful, I mean, in various ways, LBJ, FDR, Ronald Reagan, Teddy Roosevelt, Bill Clinton, they all seem to have a zest for politics. They like the give and take. They like the twisting of arms. They like the cajoling. They liked all the things that presidents do. But I don't sense that you have the same feeling that they did. It makes me wonder, do you like politicians? Do you like politics?
You know,
do you like this job?
Well, let me tell you, Bob, I love this job. And here's, I think, a fair statement. If your name is Barack Hussein Obama, you had to have liked politics in order to get into this office. You know, I wasn't born into politics and wasn't encouraged to go into politics. I got into politics because I believed I could make a difference, and I would not have been successful and would not be sitting at this desk every day if I didn't love politics. You know, the fact is that we wouldn't have gotten health care passed if there wasn't a whole bunch of arm twisting. We would not have been able to make progress on the deficit if I hadn't been willing to cut some deals with Republicans. I think every president that you've mentioned would also say that while they were in office, people weren't always as complimentary of them as when they left.
But is it what you thought it would be?
You know, here's one thing that I will say, that campaigning and governance are two different things. I've ran two successful campaigns. And anybody who's seen me on the campaign trail can tell how much I love just being with the American people and hearing what they care about and how passionate I am about trying to help them. When you start governing, there is a tendency sometimes for me to start thinking, as long as I get the policy right, then that's what should matter. And, you know, people have asked, you know, what do you need to do differently going forward? And I think you do that gut check after every election.
What do you need to do differently?
And I think that one thing that I do need to constantly remind myself and my team of is it's not enough just to build a better mousetrap. People don't automatically come beating to your door. We've got to sell it. We've got to reach out to the other side and where possible, persuade. And I think there are times, there's no doubt about it, where I think we have not been successful in going out there and letting people know what it is that we're trying to do and why this is the right direction. So there is a failure of politics there that we've got to improve on.
What criticisms of your administration do you think are valid?
Well, I just mentioned one. I think that what is also true is that no matter how frustrating it can sometimes be for any president to deal with an opposition that is pretty stubborn and where there are really strong differences, you just got to keep on trying.
Let's talk about immigration. You have said you're going to change immigration policy with an executive order by the end of the year. Republicans said, don't do it. Mitch McConnell, it's like waving a red flag in front of a bull. John Boehner, when you play with matches, you take the risk of burning yourself. Why not give them a chance to see what they can do on that and then take the executive order?
Number one, everybody agrees the immigration system's broken. And we've been talking about it for years now in terms of fixing it. We need to be able to secure our border. We need to make a legal immigration system that is more efficient. And we need to make sure that the millions of people who are here, many who have been here for a decade or more, and have American kids and for all practical purposes are part of our community, that they pay a fine, they pay any penalties, they learn English, they get to the back of the line, but they have a capacity to legalize themselves here, because we don't have the capacity to deport 11 million people. Everybody agrees on that. I presided over a process in which the Senate produced a bipartisan bill. I then said to John Boehner, John, let's get this passed through the House. For a year, I stood back and let him work on this. He decided not to call the Senate bill, and he couldn't produce his own bill. And I told him at the time, John, if you don't do it, I've got legal authority to make improvements on the system. I'd prefer and still prefer to see it done through Congress, but every day that I wait, we're misallocating resources. We're deporting people that shouldn't be deported. We're not deporting folks that are dangerous and need to be deported. So, John, I'm going to give you some time, but if you can't get it done before the end of the year, I'm going to have to take the steps that I can to improve the system.
So are you saying here today their time has run out?
What I'm saying to them, actually, their time hasn't run out. I'm going to do what I can do through executive action. It's not going to be everything that needs to get done. And it will take time to put that in place. And in the interim, the minute they pass a bill that addresses the problems with immigration reform, I will sign it, and it supersedes whatever actions I take. And I'm encouraging them to do so. On parallel track, we're going to be implementing an executive action. But if, in fact, a bill gets passed, nobody's going to be happier than me to sign it, because that means it will be permanent rather than temporary. So they have the ability, the authority, the control to supersede anything I do through my executive authority by simply carrying out their functions over there. And if, in fact, it's true that they want to pass a bill, they've got good ideas, nobody's stopping them, and the minute they do it, and the minute I sign that bill, then what I've done goes away.
We're going to have to take a break here. We'll be back in 1 minute.
I'm Lex Friedman. I run my own business, so I know from experience, hiring new employees can be tough. Posting your job in one place isn't enough to find quality candidates. If you want to find the perfect hire, you need to post your job on all the top job sites, and now you can. With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post your job to 50-plus job sites, including Craigslist, LinkedIn, and Twitter, all with a single click. Find candidates in any industry nationwide. Just post once and watch your qualified candidates roll in to ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Quickly screen candidates, rate them, and hire the right person fast. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by over 200,000 businesses. And right now, our listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/WSJ. That's ZipRecruiter.com/WSJ. One more time, to try it for free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/WSJ.
You sent a secret letter to Iran's supreme commander, or supreme leader, last month about our two countries' shared interest in fighting ISIS. I guess I'd ask you the first question, has he answered?
I tend not to comment on any communications that I have with various leaders. I've got a whole bunch of channels where we're communicating to various leaders around the world. Let me speak more broadly about the policies vis-a-vis Iran. We have two big interests in Iran that are short-term, and then we've got a long-term interest. Our number one priority with respect to Iran is making sure they don't get a nuclear weapon. And because of the unprecedented sanctions that this administration put forward and mobilized the world to abide by, they got squeezed, their economy tanked, and they came to the table in a serious way for the first time in a very, very long time. We've now had significant negotiations. They have abided by freezing their program and, in fact, reducing their stockpile of nuclear-grade material or weapons-grade nuclear material. And the question now is, are we going to be able to close this final gap so that they can re-enter the international community, sanctions can be slowly reduced, and we have verifiable, Loctite assurances that they can't develop a nuclear weapon. There's still a big gap. We may not be able to get there. The second thing that we have an interest in is that Iran has influence over Shia, both in Syria and in Iraq, and we do have a shared enemy in ISIL. But I've been very clear publicly and privately, we are not connecting in any way the nuclear negotiations from the issue of ISIL. We're not coordinating with Iran on ISIL. There is some deconflicting in the sense that since they have some troops or militias they control in and around Baghdad, yeah, we let them know, don't mess with us. We're not here to mess with you. We're focused on our common enemy. Well, but there's no coordination or common battle plan, and there will not be because, and this brings me to the third issue, we still have big differences with Iran's behavior vis-a-vis our allies. Poking and prodding at creating unrest and sponsoring terrorism in the region, around the world, their anti-Israeli rhetoric and behavior. So that's a whole other set of issues, which prevents us from ever being true allies.
Is it still our policy that we want President Assad of Syria to go?
It is still our policy, and it's an almost absolute certainty that he has lost legitimacy with such a large portion of the country by dropping barrel bombs and killing children and destroying villages that were defenseless, that he can't regain the kind of legitimacy that would stitch that country back together again. Now, obviously, our priority is to go after ISIL. And so what we have said is that we are not engaging in a military action against the Syrian regime. We are going after ISIL facilities and personnel who are using Syria as a safe haven in service of our strategy in Iraq. We do want to see a political settlement inside of Syria. That's a long-term proposition. We can't solve that militarily, nor are we trying to.
Let me ask you this. You had a tough summer. We saw the rise of ISIS, the outbreak of Ebola, trouble in the Ukraine, illegal immigrants coming across the border. Did you ever go back to the residence at night and say, are we ever going to get a break here?
We have had a busy 6 years. This summer it seemed to compress even more. But think about when I came into office. It was worse because the economy, not just here in the United States, but globally, was in a free fall. I have great confidence in the American people, and I have great confidence in this administration being able to work through and eventually solve problems. Sometimes we don't do it at the speed keeps up with the press cycle. So we've handled Ebola well, but and folks aren't talking about it as much now, but there was a period of time where people are anxious. You'll recall just a year in office when there was a big hole in the middle of the Gulf spewing out oil. And we went through a month that was real tough. Nobody talks about now because we actually had a really effective response against the worst environmental disaster in American history. But when you solve the problem, sometimes the cameras have gone away. When the problem comes up, it's tough. But I tell you, what keeps me going every day is to see how resilient the American people are, how hard they work. Nothing I go through compares to a guy who's lost his job or lost his home or lost his retirement savings or is trying to figure out how to send his kid to college. What I keep on telling my team here is don't worry about the fact that we're overworked or we're, you know, getting picked on. Yeah, that's all irrelevant. What is relevant is we have the chance to help that person every single day, and we do. And sometimes you're going to get fanfare for it, and sometimes you're not. But I still consider this the best job on earth, and I'm going to try to squeeze every last ounce of possibility the ability to do good out of this job in these next 2 years.
6 years into an administration is the time that presidents seem to make changes, some of them trying to really shake things up. They bring in new people. They launch new programs. Do I get the sense that you're not planning something like that?
Well, I think there are always going to be changes. I mean, if you look at after each election.
But I don't see that you're, from what I've heard from you so far, you don't plan to do much different than what you've done so far.
You know, Bob, I think that what you'll see is a constant effort to improve the way we deliver service to customers, experimenting with ways that I can reach out to Republicans more effectively, making sure that we're reaching out and using the private sector more effectively. One of the things we're learning is that there's a real power to being able to convene here in the White House. Not every problem has to be solved just through a bill, just through legislation. We will be bringing in new folks here because people get tired. You know, it's a hard job. And what I've told everybody is, you know, I want you to have as much enthusiasm and energy on the last day of this administration as you do right now or as you did when you first started. Otherwise, you shouldn't be here.
You came here talking about hope and change. Do you still hope? Is change, was it harder than you thought it would be?
Well, you know, I always thought change was going to be hard. But I will tell you, Bob, when I look back over the last 6 years, I am really proud of the fact that people have jobs who didn't have them before. People have health insurance who didn't have it before. Young people are going to college who couldn't afford it before. So we've made big changes. But what makes me hopeful is the American people. And change is inevitable because we got the best cards. We got the best workers. This incredible system that attracts talent from around the world. We continue to be a beacon for freedom and democracy. We've got an extraordinary military. We've got an economy that's growing faster than anybody else's. We've got these incredible natural resources, and we are the most innovative anybody on Earth. So there's no reason for us not to succeed, and change will happen. But, you know, America's always at the forefront of change. That's our trademark. You know, even after over 200 years, we're still a young country, and we don't fear the future. We grab it.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you so much, Bob. I enjoyed it.
If you haven't figured it out by now, the truth is I love moderating Face the Nation. I was going to tell you why, but then I thought, why not just show you?
Face the Nation.
How do you do? And welcome to Face the Nation.
I think a lynching bee is a good name for it.
I can prophesize that your grandchildren in America will live under socialism.
Very good. I am not communist at all, but I will never be against any right.
We find now that the forces of darkness are much more active, zealous, and conscientious and determined than the forces of light.
Did you really call a fellow member of the board a lying son of a bitch?
Very quietly, I expressed a long-held opinion quite forcefully to the individual.
With all due respect to Congressman Kerry, he's a congressman. He's not Secretary of State.
If, as you say, there is nothing there, Mr. President, how can so many reputable, respected professionals keep pressing on with this?
Well, that's your characterization, not mine.
You may go on asking the same question in 100 different ways, and you will still get the same answer.
Dr. King was said, my dream is in the process of becoming real.
Listen to me. I'm here talking to Bob Schieffer. I'm doing anything.
Well, may I just say that I think I've fallen in love with you, and that hasn't happened to me on this broadcast very often. It doesn't get much better than that. We'll be right back.
Mailing your letters and packages has just gotten a lot easier, thanks to Stamps.com. With Stamps.com, you can mail and ship anything, anywhere using your computer and printer. No more trips to the post office. And it's so easy, anyone could do it. Just click, print, and mail. With Stamps.com, buy and print official U.S. postage right from your desk. Stamps.com does all the work for you. They'll even give you a digital scale that automatically calculates exact postage for any letter, any package, and any class of mail. Setup is easy, too. In minutes, you'll be printing your own postage. You'll never have to go to the post office again. Right now, get this special offer from Stamps.com when you use the promo code 60MINUTES. A no-risk trial, plus a $110 bonus offer that includes a digital scale and up to $55 in free postage. Don't wait. Go to Stamps.com, and before you do anything else, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in 60 minutes. That's Stamps.com, promo code 60 minutes.
Welcome back to Face the Nation. Former President George W. Bush has written a book about his dad, 41, and we went to his library in Robert Dallas Stern. To talk with him about it. Many of you saw part one of that story on Sunday morning. In part two, the former president talked a little politics, including the possibility that his brother Jeb may run for president in 2016.
You know, it's a lot of speculation about him. I occasionally fuel the speculation by saying that I hope he runs. I think he'd be a very good president. I understand the decision-making process pretty well, and I know that he's wrestling with the decision.
If you had to make an estimate right now. What do you think is going to happen? You think he's going to
I think
do
it's
it?
50-50. Look, he and I are very close. On the other hand, he's not here knocking on my door, you know, agonizing about the decision. He knows exactly the ramifications on family, for example. He's seen his dad and his brother go through the presidency. I'd give it a toss up. I know this about Jeb. He's not afraid to succeed. In other words, I think he knows he could do the job. And nor is he afraid to fail.
For your brother, is it worth putting a family through?
Yeah, it is.
Is it?
I think it is, yeah. I mean, I put our family through it. And one of the lessons you learn from George H.W. Bush is that you can go into politics and still be a good father. In other words, the priorities of your life don't have to be compromised. I know Jeb's priority is his family. A priority is his family. I also know it's his country and his deep faith. And he has seen that you don't have to sell those out in order to be a politician.
But it was family that almost kept 41 from running again. In 1991, George Bush told his son he was seriously considering not running again because of his son Neil's legal troubles with a failed savings and loan. George W. Bush's response, "You've still got work to do, and the country needs you." For Bush, the hardest part of being a president's son was seeing his father lose.
The 92 defeat was really hard, and it ironically enough, it did make it easier for me, because when people criticized my dad, somebody who I admire greatly, I didn't react well at times, and it really, really affected me. When they criticized me, the sting wasn't nearly as difficult. It actually, being his son during his presidency, created kind of a layer of asbestos. The only thing I was concerned about was that how would my girls react when they were put in the same position I had been in?
Would his father have won re-election if Texas billionaire Ross Perot had not entered the race unexpectedly and made it a three-way contest with Bill Clinton?
I think he'd have won.
You do think so?
I do, yeah, absolutely. I think he'd have won, and I just can't prove it. I mean, it's just all conjecture, of course. But I think he would have won because I think ultimately there would have been a clear choice between, a guy who had a very good first term and a untested governor.
After the Gulf War, when your father drove Saddam Hussein back into Iraq, his favorable rating went to 89%. But then
he was defeated in the in the election.
Plunged from 89 to 39 on the poll that really mattered.
How did that affect you?
It's an interesting lesson of how to spend political capital. In the book, I'm was somewhat dismayed about the inability for the White House to connect the message to connect with the American people that domestic politics really mattered for George Bush as much as international politics. In other words, he had a lot of capital to spend, and I didn't. In retrospect, it wasn't spent wisely. Mm-hmm.
You write in the book, when you decided to send troops into Iraq, it was not to finish what your dad had started.
There are very few defensive moments of the book, and that happens to be one. I guess I was just responding to kind of the gossip that tends to work around the political circles, that clearly he had only one thing in mind, and that was to finish the job his father did. Because my dad decided not to go into Baghdad after routing Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait. And the reason why is that wasn't the mission, he stated. And so I went in there as a result of a very changed environment because of September the 11th. And the danger we were concerned about was that the weapons would be put into the hands of terrorist groups that would come and make the attacks of 9/11 pale in comparison. And since this is a book about my dad, I thought it was necessary to kind of set the record straight.
But you said in the book, he was right, and I was right, too, in 2003.
Right. I agree. Glad you read that part of it.
Were you surprised when you gave the ultimatum to Saddam that he didn't leave? Did you think there was a chance he
would really leave? I really did, yeah.
You really did?
I did, yeah. You know, when he was captured, I was told that the FBI agent that talked to him, he said, I just didn't believe Bush. And it's hard for me to believe he didn't believe me. Mm-hmm. We'd given an ultimatum to the Taliban and delivered. I make the point in the book, of course, that, and Dad understood this better than anybody, that when you say something as president, you better mean it. Mm-hmm. Words mean something. Mm-hmm. And he was very clear at times during his presidency and meant it. I thought I was pretty clear at times during my presidency and meant it. Saddam Hussein didn't believe us. I was surprised.
But you thought that he would believe you and that he would leave.
I thought there was a chance, yeah. I certainly hoped so. But he didn't. And so that's why I put in the book, he chose war. Twice he choose war, during 41 and 43.
When former First Lady Laura Bush joined us, we turned back to the possibility of a Bush 45.
So let's talk about the Bush dynasty here. Your mom says there have been enough Bushes running for president. What do you two think about that?
Sometimes her prognostications haven't been very accurate. And I think you have to earn your way into politics. I don't think anything's ever given to you.
I think the question that every candidate faces, and you have a unique perspective on this, is it worth putting the family through it?
Well, that's what every candidate has to think about, because it is. And even since George and I lived at the White House, the social media has increased so much, and lots of mean and terrible things on the internet about every family member, which even we didn't have. But I think that that everyone has to weigh that.
From your perspective, has politics? My sense is it's gotten a lot meaner.
In the older days, I hate to be one of these guys that talk about the old days, and you're able to do that yourself, by the way. People were held to account for what they said. In other words, there was a pushback. Now there's just so much stuff out there, floatsome out there, that people say what they feel like saying without any consequence.
If Jeb Bush does run, will you be campaigning for him? Might be a different
It
situation.
Will be totally different. I'll do whatever he wants. I will be one of his strongest backers. If he wants me out there publicly, I'll be out there publicly. If he wants me behind the scenes, I'll be behind the scenes. I'm all in for him. He'd be a great president, and country could use an optimistic view like his.
What about you?
I agree, absolutely.
Would you campaign too?
Sure. If he wanted me to, I'd be happy to campaign for him.
Well, I want to wish you both the best.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you so much, Bob.
Really glad to have you back in the promised land.
It's great to be here.
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much.
Now, with our panel to talk about all of this in the election on Tuesday, Peggy Noonan, a contributor to CBS News Now and Wall Street Journal columnist, of course, the legendary Bob Woodward of the Washington Post, Michelle Norris from National Public Radio. Michelle, you're not old enough to be a legend yet.
Okay, there's still time.
Coming right along. And David Gergen of Harvard, who's been in both Republican and Democratic administrations. It's really a contrast, isn't it, to see a president and a former president on the same broadcast. I think it's a lot easier for former presidents to speak on television than it is presidents, Michelle.
Obviously. I mean, just the body language, the comfort. President Bush talked about a layer of asbestos, a phrase that we probably would not hear roll off his tongue when he was in sort of the constrained and very scripted environment of the presidency. But it's also interesting that there was a through line for some of the things that they were saying when they were talking about the reasons for going to war, when they were talking about, when President Bush was talking about messaging, it sort of echoed some of the challenges that President Obama faces today. But boy, what a contrast to see the two of them.
In part, it was what we saw here was a portrait of two presidents. One is a happy man, having lived through history and being satisfied with the role he played. The other is a sitting president who just took it straight on the jaw in an election, who's feeling stressed, who made a point of saying he loves his office, but it made you sit back and think, yeah, are you sure you do? It was the difference between being in the thick of it and having the tranquility of reflection and retirement.
Bob, what's your takeaway?
Well, one similarity is they're both selling something. George W. Bush is selling a book, and Obama is selling what happened in the midterm election and trying to put the best spin on it. I found the interview with Obama very revealing, because he said he's going to reach out to the other side to persuade and sell. Now, if you're going to reach out to the other side on something, one of the things you want to do is listen. But we didn't hear that. And what we heard is the continuous Obama line, I'm heading in the right direction. This is right. And no one knows better than Obama that all these powers are shared with Congress, and a go-it-alone approach just is not going to work.
David?
I think we got a good revealing example today of why ex-presidents tend to go up in their popularity. Once they leave office, they can be more candid, they can be a little funnier, and they can talk about, they can show a personality, and they're not pulled into the politics of Washington and what seems to diminish everybody who comes here. Once you're out of that, he's just more refreshing, he's more interesting. And I thought President Obama has the capacity. He wrote, the first book he wrote was one of the best books ever written by a politician. There's memoirs. I think he has a capacity to write the best memoir since Ulysses Grant, which was more about the war. But the way he now talks, everything is deflected. Everything is, you don't really get an understanding of who he is and what he's really thinking. You get a sense of what the line is.
Yeah. He also, I think the president has taken to putting a lot of padding in his sentences.
Right.
You can say the words, I like you, or you can give a 14-word sentence that has codicils and parentheses and stuff. Do you know what I mean? That's what you do when you're running out the clock and there's a certain running out going on. But I think one of the really big stories that we saw in your interview, but also in the past few days with the president, is that a very significant historic election occurred. Everybody looked at the president like, what does this change for you? And he has made it clear one way and another, and in this interview, I think, that this will not change his method of operation a bit, which means he's not going to change his relationship with the Congress, which means more of the past 6 years.
We don't know that.
Do you agree with that, Michelle?
We don't know that. We don't know that, though, because, I mean, part of presidential strategy, part of political strategy is not necessarily revealing your hand. And you noted that the president may be running down the clock. And if you actually talk to people in the White House, there's an indication that that's not the case. In fact, Dennis McDonough has been reminding people on staff of something that the president has said repeatedly, that important things can and do happen in the fourth quarter. He is a very competitive guy. Yeah. Anyone who knows him well knows just how competitive he is. So the idea of sitting back and running out the clock and doing the same thing that has led you to a point of defeat just doesn't seem like that would be the playbook going forward.
I think that's fundamentally right about the fourth quarter. I think they do want, they do see it as a fourth quarter. He's got to pick up his game. He's got to play, he's 20 points back, and he's acting like he's ahead. And he just has to communicate better. And one thing we saw today was, which I thought was very, very clear, yet once again, he says, look, I want to change. I want to reach out to the Republicans. I want to change the whole thing. But by the way, I'm going to sign this executive order, period, end of sentence. And I think most people in Washington think that's going to throw a hand grenade into the middle of these conversations with the Republicans.
Well, you know, the Washington Post said as much, and they've not always been anxious to criticize the president.
But it's a disengaged style that, in terms of Congress, that just is not working, and he looks isolated. Now, if you, as you suggest, you talk to people in the White House and try to enter in and understand the mind of President Obama, he looks at the critics and he says, "No, wait a minute. They're saying things like on your editorial page saying that it's been 6 years of economic catastrophe." And he says, "No, wait a minute. Look at all of the things we did," and he's really got a point. And so you get this kind of wall that he builds up, but so does the opposition.
Well, that's
and
what
somebody's got to tear that wall down.
I'm just going to say this. Sources have told me that the president met with the congressional leaders on Friday for lunch. The president of the United States announced he held this announcement until he could brief these congressional leaders about it. He's sending more Americans into harm's way in a very dangerous place. He's doubling the size of the U.S. military commitment year there. Yet, I am told 90% of this meeting was an argument between the Republicans who were there and the president over whether he was going to issue this executive order on immigration. I think the president's done a lot of things wrong in how he deals with Washington, but it seems to me, and I think you're right, the other side's got to kind of figure out a way to change the way they do business, too, if anything is going to happen.
There may be some indication, though, that the newly elected members that are heading to Washington get that message. I mean, Cory Gardner just said that Washington has to lead with competence and maturity. They're, you know, sending a message that they want to perhaps distance themselves from a do-nothing label, that perhaps it is time, the voters have spoken, to get something done.
But he's the CEO. He's the boss. And he's the one who's got to set the tone. And you have to, and if you chart the time he spends in these meetings and these discussions, it's not enough to really get to know somebody. I mean, he said to you, he kept saying, "Well, I'm going to sell and persuade." Two words we didn't hear: listen and compromise. And that's what you have to do, even when you're the boss.
Yeah, I'm going to
take it.
Could I also note there were, I think, not enough of the big meeting on Friday between the congressional leaders and the president was devoted to the new decision on Iraq. I get that. But that decision came 2 days after the election, which immediately makes people think, hey, what the heck? Did the timing of this decision and announcement have any connection with the fact that America was voting all day Tuesday and this will be a very controversial decision? But I will say, second, Bob's right. A president sets a tone. When the president of the United States on Wednesday afternoon listens to the soon-to-be Republican majority leader Mitch McConnell say, "I got to be frank, if the president does a big executive order on immigration and amnesty, that will, quote, poison the well with Congress." And the president, an hour or two later, came on and said, "By the way, I am going to do this." I just,
I put my head in my hands. I thought, oh, no.
Well, David.
Bob, I think you're absolutely right. At a fundamental level, the Republicans have to learn how to compromise as well. They have to meet him halfway. And I don't think we know yet whether John Boehner can still deliver the House. You know, I don't know whether he has the votes to go to a compromise, say, on immigration. He couldn't get there last time. You know, can he get there now? I don't think we know. The Tea Party, as we know, is stirring. They're not happy with the direction the leadership is taking. We'll have to see how it all works out. Having said that, the president is the one who lost the elections. So the graceful thing then is the person who loses. Not the party that wins doesn't say, well, okay, we're willing to compromise. The loser has to say, I'm going to be willing to change course, as Bob said. And then the Republicans have to respond. And if the president, the first moment out of the box, says, by the way, I really want to work with you, first I'm going to spit in your face over immigration, then let's sit down and compromise.
Yeah.
Would the president and the Democrats be better off if the Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid resigned, as party leaders often do when their party loses the majority? I hear some people say yes, and because what I'm wondering about after the talk after this election, I think the president's relations with the Democrats in the Senate may be as bad as his relations with the Republicans.
That's absolutely true. And you get the Democrats in private, and they are on fire. Just because he won't spend the time, because he won't listen. I mean, Peggy said it yesterday in her column, and I think there's a real truth here. Humility is power. And after you lose, you have to come out and kind of face up to that. And there's a whole undercurrent in the president's approach that, well, you know, it was bad, but, you know, that was worse than bad. And I think optimistically. I think he's capable, and as your suggestion, he's capable of changing and engaging in that outreach, and he just needs to do it and kind of get out of this bubble of that he seems to be living.
Can I just point something out, though? At this very table, expressions of humility have been interpreted as weakness. And often when he takes that posture, when people were saying he should have been more contrite, you can almost hear the reaction to that if that had happened. And so there's another way of looking at that.
Do you mean that happened before, that he was humble and he was criticized for humility?
Oh, I do. Yes, I do. I think we've all
You know,
seen that.
What I would say, in the age of the Internet and the web has no sense of humor. The web has no sense of irony.
Yeah.
You cannot be self-deprecating because people say, Bob Schieffer finally admitted he was a fool.
That's right.
And
that's right.
They
there's
don't
no
know
nuance.
It's a joke. There may be something to what Michelle says here. I want to thank all of you for joining with us today and being with us.
Now that the situation is well in hand, gentlemen, our time is up.
Thank you very much indeed for coming here to Face the Nation.
Gentlemen, I'm sorry, but our time is up. Thank you, Dr. King, for being our guest today on Face the Nation.
Mr. Carmichael, I sincerely regret, but our time is up.
Thank
you for being here to Face the Nation.
I'm sorry, Governor. We're just about off the clock at this point. Thank you very much for being with us here to Face the Nation.
I'm Leslie Stahl. Have a good week.
And that's it for us today. We'll see you next week right here on Face the Nation. Today's guests were President Barack Obama and former President George W. Bush. The executive producer of Face the Nation is Mary Hager. The senior producers are Rob Hendon and Jill Jackson. The broadcast was directed by Sue Ann Stocky Wayne. Face the Nation originates from CBS News in Washington. For more Face the Nation, we're online at facethenation.com. And you can follow Face the Nation, Bob Schieffer, and CBS Radio News on Twitter, Facebook,